I'd like to talk about a man that if you walk through the museum, any building in the museum, any gallery in the museum, you're going to find, if not a direct handprint, you're going to find fingerprints that this man left for the entire history of the United States Air Force and its predecessors. It's Hap Arnold. It's a man we all know. I'm not sure that everybody knows as much about him as we should know. I keep learning things about the man, and I'm always impressed by the man. It never ceases to amaze me what all this man did. Very interesting. So let's get started talking about him. Henry Harley Arnold was born in Gladwin, Pennsylvania. It's a little town just north of Philadelphia. I guess it's kind of eaten up by Philadelphia by now. But he was the son of a physician, middle-class background, like so many of the air power leaders the United States had in the Second World War. This man, however, grew up to be the most significant military aviator in American military aviation history, if not just the 20th century, quite possibly for the rest of the time for the United States Air Force. Now, when he was a kid, the family called him Harley. They didn't call him Henry. His nickname was Harley, so everybody spoke to him as Harley. Here he is, age 13. Don't you just love the way he's standing in the nice Victorian chair, stiff? He's already got that little smile for which he became so famous. Normal, middle-class kid in America, did all the things he was supposed to. He went to school in Ardmore, Pennsylvania, and this photograph shows him. This is, as you can tell, 1903. That's convenient. But he's age 17, and he's looking for a career, and he's thinking about what he's going to do, and he finally decides on going to West Point, which is what he does. This is his high school drama club, and he was in a play in his Lower Merion High School in Ardmore, Pennsylvania. He's accepted to and attends the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. He graduates in 1907. During this time, he had a couple of nicknames, and one of them actually stuck. His best-known nickname was Pewt, P-E-W-T, which is a strange name. I don't know where he got it, but he got the nickname Pewt. And he also had the nickname Benny. Up until about the 1930s, everybody knew him as Pewt Arnold. So you get letters signed, Dear Pewt. It gets a little confusing when he's got three or four and his mother's calling him something. His mother calls him Sonny, by the way. Not it's S-U-N-N-Y, like a sunny disposition. Well, as you can tell, when you look at this picture, the eyes, already there's something there. This guy's a troublemaker. He was a prankster. He did not do real well in school. He finished 60th out of a class of 110, and it was so low that he could not get into the cavalry. That's what he wanted to be, was a cavalry officer. That was the cool thing to do, was be a cavalry officer. Well, his grades were so poor, he was banished to the lowly infantry, which he never really appreciated at all. Grudgingly, he accepted his commission in the infantry, and it was either that or not do anything. So he took it, and he said, all right, I'll put up with it. And his first assignment was to the Philippines with the infantry, and he didn't like it at all. Here he is. Notice the nice beard. This is the Philippines. He's on the island of Luzon, and they're out mapping. You can see what they're doing. He's in charge of mapping and providing support to the engineers. And, of course, you cannot have a good Air Force photograph without a dog somewhere, and this is the dog in the photograph. Here he is with the 29th Infantry Regiment on a topographical map. So the man's learning a different trade right off the bat. Doesn't get out of it. But at that time, Army officers were expected to learn how to do multiple tasks at one time. You can see how thin the young man is. However, he does not like the idea of staying a lieutenant for long, so he tries to find a way to be promoted. He hates the infantry. So he keeps trying to find ways to get out of this and get to something better and move up in the world. So what he finally does is he takes an assignment to the Governor's Island in New York, and he leaves the Philippines, and on the way he stops in Paris on the way home. While he's in Paris, he sees Blériot with his airplane, and he thinks, oh, that's nice, that's pretty cool, no big deal. Goes back to New York, he's at Governor's Island, and lo and behold, he gets to see a couple of aircraft flying around. The Wright brothers and Glenn Curtiss are flying around, and he starts getting interested, especially finds out that there are possibilities going into this new air service that the Signal Corps got going on, so he starts asking questions about it. And finally, in 1911, he volunteers, and he's accepted into the Signal Corps' brand new aviation program. So what they do is they take him and they send him to Dayton, Ohio, to study with the Wright brothers. This is a fairly rare photograph of him with Orville. This man was his instructor. Arthur Al was what most people knew him by, Welsh. Pretty good instructor, better than a pretty good pilot. He was one of the Wright brothers' favorite pilots, by the way. He taught Hap Arnold how to fly. And by the way, this is interesting because this is the first Jewish aviator. Right off the bat, early in Hap Arnold's career, he's being exposed to things that so many other Army officers were not getting. Here he is at the Wright School. You will notice that he is not wearing a uniform. Now, granted, the photograph of the Philippines did not look like much of a uniform either. However, in the States, Army officers only wore their uniforms on post. They did not wear them out in the civilian world. So here he is in a Wright flyer. He earns civilian license number 29 on the 6th of July in 1911. He received the first rating of military aviator, which is the badge that comes later, on the 22nd of July, 1911. He's 25 years old in this picture. He's at the controls of a Wright B. Now, most of us here know how confusing this beast was to fly. You have to do all kinds of machinations with your hands and do things. It's not like the aircraft that pilots use today. So it was a very entertaining. Plus, trying to go from this aircraft to flying a Curtiss aircraft was dangerous. But since he learned to fly with the Wrights, he learned how to fly a Wright aircraft. So here he is. You will notice the increased safety elements of the helmet. With this aircraft, that's about all you're getting right now is that. Here he is. This is Hap Arnold standing. And this is Tom Milling, who was the two pilots that the Army chose to send to the Wright School. Here they are at the Wright School. Now, when they were flying around, if you'll notice the latest in safety equipment, you'll see something is missing. And in his biography, Hap Arnold wrote that he learned about the importance of wearing goggles, something we take pretty as, you know, you should wear goggles when you're flying, when he was hit in the eye with a bug while he's flying. He later wrote about this. Now, this is pretty good. The possibility of being rammed by a bug had not occurred to us before. After that, we wore goggles. This is learning as you go along. Welsh could only teach him a certain amount of things, and everything else they had to learn on their own. Here he is, sitting in a Wright B flyer. Now, this is at College Park, Maryland. This is where the Army set up its flying school. And there are two pilots in the Army, so guess what they were assigned to do? Train others to be pilots. So that's what Hap Arnold's doing. He and Milling both go to College Park for the Signal Corps Aviation School. He didn't waste a lot of time before he started setting every record imaginable. But then it was so early in aviation that it was fairly easy to do. First off, he won the McKay Trophy, the first McKay Trophy, actually, for an aeronautical achievement, taking his Wright flyer and flying around on a triangular course during maneuvers. On this, he actually did reconnoitering, and he found the unit he was supposed to fly. So he received the McKay Trophy. He was the first pilot to ever carry mail. He carried some mail during a maneuver from one place to another. He was the first pilot to reach an altitude of 1 mile high. At the time, this was pretty cool stuff. This made the front pages of the newspaper. Intrepid Army aviator reaches mile high. This is big stuff. And you'll also notice he's wearing goggles. Quite a few pilots went through. This is Roy Kirtland. There's Hap, and you can see the ever-present smile on his face. Again, the hat turned around backwards. His cap is turned around backwards. The controls, this is where you keep your feet from sliding off. This is a fairly good photograph of the guys. This is around July of 1912. Here's Hap Arnold up here. He's just recently had an accident, by the way. He's been flying around in a Curtiss aircraft, and he hit the water. He gets a cut on his chin, and he keeps that scar for the rest of his life. So you can always tell after 1912 because of the scar. Of these guys, most of them lived for a while, except within this fellow right here, Rockwell, Lewis C. Rockwell. He's killed just about a month after this photograph was taken while flying. It's a dangerous business. Oh, by the way, you could not be an Army pilot if you were married. That's how dangerous it was. All right? C, a Model C flyer. The Army, this was the newest aircraft the Army picked up. In the fall of 1912, Half-Arnold took a, he and a couple other pilots took a Model C out to Fort Riley in Kansas to work with the artillery and do some experimentation. They were going to use radios on these airplanes to direct artillery. Now, this was a pretty cool idea. No one had done this before. This was brand new. And this was another first for Arnold. He was the first man to direct artillery fire from an airplane. Now, there was a problem with this airplane. It was inherently unstable, and that year 1912 was not a good year for the Army. A number of pilots, about six pilots all total, are killed or seriously injured by these airplanes before they figure out there's something really, really wrong with them. So it's a dangerous airplane to fly. Here's Arnold and Lieutenant Bradley, and they're the ones out at Fort Riley flying around using the radio, and here it is. You can barely see it on the side over here to make connections. Now, this is, photograph is taken on the 2nd of November when they're just getting ready to take off on one of their flights to work with the artillery school. 3 days later, Hap Arnold is flying this very airplane when he set another record, the first man to ever get into an uncontrolled spin and get out of it alive. He didn't know what he's doing. No one that people were getting into spins, they didn't know how to get at it, and they hit the ground. When you hit the ground, even though you're doing 45 or 50 miles an hour, but when you're falling from 90 feet, it's going to kill you. Goggles or not, it is going to kill you. So from about 400 feet up, the planes just suddenly pitched, and he didn't know why. We know what now why. He stalled the aircraft, and it goes into a spin. And he knew, he didn't know, but he push the stick forward and over like a pilot knows now in your spin to get out and pulled out. He pulled up just a few feet off the ground. The first pilot to successfully spin and recover an aircraft. Very lucky man. Did not know what he was doing, but still survived. There's a problem with this, though. Half-Arnold really has gotten shaken by this. It really, really gets to him. Because just a couple months earlier, his friend, Al Walsh, he used to go to Al Walsh's house, and his daughter, Walsh's daughter later remembered that Half-Arnold would come over and she'd sit in his lap and they'd play together and have a good time. Al Walsh was killed flying a Wright Model C with another Army pilot. So 1912 is a bad year. A number of these pilots are being killed. And Half-Arnold gets really, really rattled. He sends a letter to his commander saying, "At the present time, my nervous system is in such a condition that I will not get in any flying machine." And he has to be reassigned. He's had enough of flying. The United States' premier military aviator of the 20th century, and he's bailing out. Literally, that's it. I want no more of this. Of the first 28 pilots or so, 10 of them were killed. His friend, Walsh, had just been killed. Everybody knew how dangerous it was. This was because they wouldn't let them have a wife, because if you have a widow, then the government has to pay her, so they just won't let it happen. Half-Arnold asks for and he receives permission. He's reassigned to Washington, D.C., but fortunately for the Republic, Half-Arnold was reassigned to Washington, D.C. to work for the officer in charge of the aviation section of the Signal Corps. So even though he wasn't flying, he was staying in aviation. It's critical. He could have gone an entirely different path. Could have gone back to the infantry. Probably wouldn't have stayed there long. But for the Republic, for the United States, this is a big deal. We got very lucky and didn't know it at the time. Well, he gets a desk job. And anybody who's been in the service for any length of time, they realize you've got to know how to do paperwork and do it right. This reassignment was really good for him because it gave him the opportunity to learn how to do paperwork efficiently and quickly, the Army way. And it's absolutely mandatory for World War II to be able to do this. So he learns that. But more importantly for us, it keeps him involved in military aviation. Well, since he's not flying any longer, he doesn't have to worry about it. So he finds this young woman he's been dating for a while, and he decides to marry her. Eleanor Poole, her nickname was Bee, B-E-E, like the bumblebee. And in September 1913, they wed. That's Milling, his friend he learned to fly with, so he's still staying with these people. That's his best man. Since he was no longer on flying status, he could be reassigned, and he was reassigned to the Philippines once again. The United States, we only had about 100,000 military personnel, and there were two places that were primarily where most Army officers and the list of people went. They went to the Canal Zone, Panama Canal, or they went to the Philippines. That's why so many went in and out of the Philippines over and over and over again. And guess what? They all ran into each other. Ground guys, air guys, they met Navy guys, all going in and out of the same places. It's a small service, small Navy too, and so they could know each other, which is another benefit, and they start opening their eyes to the world. So anyway, September 1913, he's married, goes back to the Philippines. He gets there, and just about the time he gets there, this guy who's the executive officer for the aviation section gets in touch with him and says, I really want you to come back and work for the air service. He said, well, the guy's name is Billy Mitchell, and he's pretty persuasive. And what's really persuasive is Lieutenant, now married, Lieutenant Arnold, with a small paycheck, needs a bigger paycheck, and Mitchell offers him a promotion to the rank of captain. This is a big deal. Guess what Hap Arnold does? He takes it. He becomes the supply officer for the Signal Corps Aviation School in Rockwell Field, California. He's not flying, but he's still back with aviation. Here's a very interesting photograph of Hap Arnold walking with the school commander. There's Hap Arnold in his uniform. The commander is in his civvies with his nice little walking cane, walking past the doghouses. Little motorcycle with a dog tied up. An interesting photograph, a good photograph because it has a dog in it. Well, this is Colonel William Glassford, who's the commander of the school. And for 4 years, Arnold refused to have, he would not even, literally, would not get inside of an airplane. Wouldn't even just sit in one on the ground. He really got rattled. But after 4 years, he started thinking about it. And when he gets around these guys who were out there flying, it starts drawing him back. Maybe it's the castor oil they use for the lubricants. Maybe it's the smell of gasoline. Maybe it's just the smell of testosterone and the three mixed together. I don't know. He overcomes his fear, though. This is a really important thing for a man to overcome the type of fear that he had. But Hap Arnold overcomes this. And he's lured back into the air. Here he is, shown during requalification. He learns to fly again. Again, this is courage, quiet courage at the utmost. And most people don't know that Hap Arnold quit flying for a while. And with good reason, I might add. But this is just on the verge of World War I for the United States. April 1917, the United States goes to war. And what's every join the air service, get over there with the air service, serve in France? Hap Arnold immediately puts his name in for combat assignment. And, of course, in his ultimate wisdom, what does the Army do? The best pilot in the Army, what do they do with him? They put him behind a desk. Makes sense to me. But the thing is, he was the Army's top expert on training, on logistics, on supply, on acquisition, and it was too valuable to be allowed to go overseas. They needed that experience. So the Army kept him, put him in Washington, D.C., and put him in charge of aircraft production and mobilization. Now, most of us know in World War II, there were great promises of we're going to darken the skies over Europe with American-built airplanes. It didn't happen. And Hap Arnold he learns. This is where this vision thing comes in. He learns how not to do it. And the Army did it about every way they could do it wrong in building aircraft for the First World War. He becomes a deputy director of military aeronautics. And he's deeply involved with procurement and training, things that will serve him very, very well in just a few years. He's given the temporary rank of colonel, and he becomes, at age 31, the youngest He's the youngest colonel in the United States Army. The youngest colonel in the United States Army. He's also learning about research and development. They didn't really have a name for it at the time, but he was learning about getting new aircraft. He was always in his position looking for the newest thing that was going to make the American military aviation even better. Always. Never stopped looking for his entire life. And this is where he learns how to do it and do it effectively, is in this job. He becomes associated with a group of civilian scientists and engineers which becomes a recurring theme for the rest of his life. He learns the importance of engineers and of scientists and of academia to military aviation. And this group of people he starts running around with included Charles Kettering from here in Ohio, Orville Wright, he already knew Orville, Lawrence and Elmer Sperry, and another, this new guy who was doing physics, his name was Dr. Robert Millikan. He shows up a little bit later. But he starts running around with these guys because they're doing something funky, and he really likes the idea. They're working on this guided missile, the world's first effective guided missile. And there it is. There's Arnold, there on the left. That's the Kettering Bug. If you walk over to the early years gallery and look around, you'll see a replica of one, which it's an interesting little aircraft. The Kettering Bug, it's a simple weapon designed to take off on rails, carrying a bomb, flies a certain distance, the engine cuts off, the wings break off, and the bomb drops. What you're supposed to do is build lots and lots and lots and lots of these things and point a whole bunch of them at a big target like a railroad marshaling yard and just like artillery, saturate the area. But it goes much further than artillery. Well, it's not very successful. The war ends, and the Army drops the project because it's really not necessary for what the Army was going to do in the interwar period. They didn't know it was the interwar period. Remember, this was the war to end all wars. It just finished up. So Arnold stays in. But he learns about R&D. He makes connections with academia, with scientists, with engineers, with business people from all over the United States. And more importantly for down the road, he takes this thing. He's in London just after the D-Day invasion when the first V-1 rockets start hitting London. And he knows about this. He's seen this kind of stuff. He's been there. So he copies the idea and brings it back to the United States. He actually, that's why we have the one on the Air Power Gallery. So again, the future of military R&D is someplace, this is in Florida, by the way, which is grass. Very interesting man at the right place at the right time. Well, the war ends, and he's given an operational command. He's sent back to Rockwell Field as the commandant, as the commander, and he drops back to his permanent rank of major, which happened to lots and lots of people. Billy Mitchell, rank dropped back to colonel from a general. While he's at Rockwell, he does more than just be the commander. He gets involved in operational stuff. Early on, he's one of the first to start, and Billy Mitchell kind of jumps on this and takes it and runs with it, of running aerial patrols along the border. Americans tend to think that 1916, Pancho Villa, and it was all over in 1916. It wasn't. The fighting continued, bandits back and forth across the borders. They were sending routine patrols along the border looking for the Villists and other bandits coming across the border. He organized aerial forest fire patrols up and down California. Does photography, aerial photography, anything he can do to prove the value of military aviation. The problem is, no one wants to spend money on the military because the war to end all wars has just been fought. The several million man U.S. Army has just been reduced to less than 100,000 men worldwide. It's back to the pre-war years. Money is really, really tight, and no one is going to spend money on the military unless they have a good reason. So they're out trying to find a real live, no kidding mission that only the aviators can do. Well, while he's doing this, on the other side, he's doing research and development. And this shows, this is Smith and Richter getting ready to do their first aerial refueling when they just dropped the hose down and poured it basically into the tank of the aircraft. And he's wishing them well, having a nice little publicity photograph taken. Aerial refueling, this is 1923. He's already pushing the envelope of what aviation can do, and he's thinking about the future. And so there, as the unit commander, he could have stopped this if he wanted to, because it was dangerous. One spark, and that plane goes up. Well, anyway, he has his time at Rockwell Field again, and this time the Army, seeing he's doing a pretty good job, decides to send him to the Army Industrial College, which is in D.C. at the time. He goes to it. He successfully completes the courses. He comes out, and he's made the director of the U.S. Army Air Services Information Office. So now he's moved in the public affairs world. He's getting his, we call it career broadening now. He just called it a new assignment. But everything he's doing is opening his eyes just a little bit broader. His vista is getting a little further out for what aviation can do and how to promote aviation. Well, in that position, he had close contact with Billy Mitchell. And we all know the story of Billy Mitchell, 1926. The Shenandoah goes down. Billy Mitchell makes his comments. The trial goes on. Hap Arnold gets involved in it. He testifies for Mitchell, which angers people. He does more than just testify. He goes around and knocks on doors for Billy Mitchell, which angers more people. And then he does something exceedingly stupid. He goes in. He takes government paper, government stamps, government time, writes letters, and sends them not only to everybody who was in the Air Service, but he sends them to congressmen, civilians all over the United States, asking them to support military aviation. That is illegal. He had stolen government property to do this. That was at a time which, by the way, it was easier to get permission to get on a train and go from Washington, D.C. to California and back than to get permission to make a phone call. They were really tight with this sort of thing. Well, he does this, and it's really, really stupid, and he gets caught. And at first he kind of denies it. Then he says, well, okay, I'll fess up. I did this. And they say, well, we want your resignation. He goes home. He talks to his wife, Bea, and says, you know, they want me to resign. She said, well, do you like being what you're doing? And he said, yeah, I like being in the service. And she said, well, fight them. And so he said, okay. Gets her support. He goes back the next day and says, I am not going to fight you. I am going to fight you. I'm not just going to walk away. I demand a court-martial. They thought about it for a little bit, and they said, well, we've just gone through this mess with this guy. We've gotten a lot of really bad publicity. It'd be real dumb to start this all up again. So what they do is they offer him something instead. They send him out to wonderful Fort Riley, Kansas, which at the time everybody in the Army and even in the Navy knew that was the worst assignment in the U.S. military, Fort Riley, Kansas. They send him out there. Arnold goes out. But rather than going out with a bad attitude, he decides to take this opportunity. He grabs these Army officers, this is a cavalry school, he starts grabbing these guys, buttonholing them, and telling them, hey, I can do this for you, I can do that. He'd take them up, fly them around. See how I can help you with this? See what I can do? He starts winning converts to military aviation. Uses his time exceedingly well. Now, he is still a major, and that's not enough money. His family's starting to grow. He eventually has four children, one of whom does not survive early childhood, but he has three children that survive, and he and his wife need a little bit more money. Bob, this is a famous photograph of him. He's showing, that's the first production Liberty 12 engine, by the way. It's the first one turned out for actual combat purposes. But this is at Fort Riley, Kansas, and he's showing these guys what they can do, what he can do, what aviation can do. But to make a little extra money, he sees his son reading this little book one day, and he says, this is pretty much garbage. I can do better than that. And his son, he's kind of challenged, we'll do it. And he does. He writes a series of books for young men, and it's the Bill Bruce series. And he takes this fictional aviator, you can read Hap Arnold putting it in there, and he writes these young men's stories. And he sells them, and he makes some money off of it. He's actually turned out to be a pretty decent writer. They sell pretty well. But you look at the topics. Pioneer aviators, he was a pioneer. An ace, now he didn't go over there, but he knew everybody he was. He knew the stories. Border Patrol. This is kind of fantastic, flying over and dropping bombs, but it sells. And he starts a writing career that lasts the rest of his life. He learns how to write. So now we come up to one of the big questions about Hap Arnold. Why did he have the name Hap? Okay, he's had a couple other names, nicknames going along. Well, his wife wrote letters to him as Happy. She always called him Happy because he always had a little bit of a smile or a smirk on his face. It picked up. His name, around 1929, 1930, the name switches over from Pute to being Hap in correspondence. People talk of him as Hap. Hap Arnold works his way out of exile and being in the doghouse. He called himself being exiled to Fort Riley. That's what he writes about in his book, is being exiled, which was probably a good thing for him. Got him away. Let the tempers cool off a little bit. He gets support, and he's sent to the U.S. Army's Command and Staff School, which is now the Command and Staff College. And the only way you would get senior leadership positions and rank was to go to that school successfully. He gets promoted and sent to it. This is a big deal. This is a guy who they were fixing to run out of the service, and now they're saying, okay, we're going to give you a chance to be promoted to higher rank. Now, this is Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. He successfully completes it, again, broadening his education, and he goes with different... When you read about people like Carl Spotts, Spotts hated it. He went to it, and he was miserable and complained the entire time he was there. Hap Arnold kept his mouth shut. He learned to keep his mouth shut and learn his craft. Well, after graduation, he is given a command, and this is where he runs across Dayton pretty close again. The Fairfield Air Depot, and he's given command of this and the field service section. This is where he learns more things that's going to impact the Second World War than anything he's done up to this point. He's learning about logistics. He's learning about R&D. He's learning about supply. He's learning about how do you keep all these things flying? How do you continue keeping more and more of them flying? And what does he do in World War II? The very same thing. So in June of 29, the material division, he comes in and joins. Now, at that time, Wright Field was the center of all Army research and development for aviation. This was the place to be. So he could not help but run across R&D every place he stepped. He was in charge of things, and he was in charge of taking aircrafts. He took chances to do things, and he got things done. And this is now the U.S. Army Air Corps. He does good enough that he becomes the executive officer for the Materiel Division in August 1930. And this is where he runs into the high rollers in American aviation industry. He makes the transition from academia to the high rollers of business. And he learns these people's names, and he knows them well, and he is very, very good with them. He learns how to work with private industry. Not just, at this time, the Army still had this idea that we need to build our own airplanes, do our own designs, whereas he's starting to say, well, you know, there's another way to do this. Again, he's thinking a little bit further beyond than his contemporaries. Now, for a local connection, we can now visit the Arnold House. It's up the hill. This is his family from the time he was here. He lived in the Arnold House from 1921 to 1929 to 1931, and he stays a major. He spent 11 years as a major. That was pretty good, actually. Most people never got to be major. Most people never got past lieutenant. They put 20 years in and still be a lieutenant. So he's doing pretty good for himself. But in 1931, he's done well enough that the Army promotes him to the rank of lieutenant colonel, which is fairly high rank at that time, considering the small number of lieutenant colonels of slots available. And they move him to March Field, where he becomes the commander of this little training field. And his job is to turn this little training field into an operational field. And he goes out, and he does a pretty good job. Here he is in the seat of a Keystone. That's Milling again. He and Milling had their picture taken every time they could get a chance for public affairs purposes. He turns it into a first-rate, top-notch operational facility. He knows how to command men. He knows how to get things done. And he knows how to go beyond just the limits of what he's expected to do. He gets in trouble a couple of times. He does things like, oh, there's floods, and so he takes Army blankets and flies them out and just drops them to people who need them. He got in serious trouble for doing that because, again, he was stealing government property. But a couple of congressmen said, wait a minute, no. And so the Army backed off on it. That was the kind of stuff he was willing to take the chances necessary to get his job done. Hap Arnold figures out they're close to Los Angeles, which has got Hollywood. This is B.B. Davis. He learns that, oh, people like actors and actresses. If I get them to come down, they're going to pay attention to what we're doing. If they pay attention to what we're doing, we're going to get more money. And it works. So what he does, this is the maneuvers that's going on in October 1932. And B.B. Daniels was a very popular actress at the time. You'll see she's holding a radio, and Hap's just laughing, having a grand old time. See all the people back there watching what's going on? There's a bunch of pursuit aircraft, fighter planes flying around, and she's talking to the guys flying around. This is pretty cool stuff for 1932. You can look at the size of the massive radios over here. Anytime he could get a chance to have a politician come out, he'd have him come out. There are photographs of him with the governor of California. The governor's wearing a silk hat and walking around. It's very 1930s. It couldn't be any more 1930s and have the planes all lined up and having a grand time. Not only that, but he supports the aviation industry by allowing his planes to fly in movies. He actually flies a couple of planes in movies. He's hidden. And he flies in, I think, the movie Wings is this big one he was in. But he's not in it because he's hiding under the cockpit while the actor's pretending like he's flying when the camera's rolling. In 1934... Hap Arnold gets a very, very serious challenge. President Roosevelt's Postmaster General found out that the previous Postmaster General Republican, had been colluding with big industry to move mail contracts just to big industries, and they were cutting people out. This was illegal. Roosevelt asked the Army, he asked General Floyd specifically, who was the commander of the Army Air Corps at the time, tell me, can you fly the mail? Well, Floyd says, yes, we can fly the mail. We can be happy to do that. And Floyd, in his memoirs, later said, I didn't think he meant right then, but all of the Washington newspapers were saying that FDR was going to do this before he met with Floyd. So either Floyd didn't read the newspapers or he forgot. Anyway, Roosevelt says the Army is going to fly the mail. He cancels all the airmail contracts in 1934, and the Army picks it up. The problem is the Army is basically a daylight Air Force. And when do they fly the mail? At night, because it's got to be the next morning for delivery. So the Army is trying to fly a night mission with daytime airplanes that are not really well equipped. They're not trained. They don't have the instrument training they need that the airmail pilots had. They didn't need it at that time. And the Army Air Corps got lucky enough that this was the worst winter in like 30 years. So a couple of pilots are killed, and right off the bat, things get worse and worse and worse, and it becomes the first chance that the Republicans had to hit Franklin Roosevelt around the head. And they hit him pretty hard with it, and they used the Army as the bat with which to whack him. So lots of bad press for the Army, really bad press. It looks really, really bad, except for one area. F. Arnold was in charge of flying the Western Division, and his weather was as bad as anybody's. But he knew what he was doing. He organized his people. He didn't take chances. This is an observation plane. This is an O-25. You can see they just closed off the observation. They put the mail inside there. Air Mail 5. His organization did a pretty good job. Well, the Army finally gets their act together. They start flying the mail pretty well. The weather lightens up. Things are going okay. Well, by this time they have the contracts worked out, and they take the mission away from the Army, and the damage has been done. Benny Floyd never really recovers from this. He ends up having to leave his office later. But other people shone very brightly, in particular Hap Arnold. To try to get over the hangover of the airmail fiasco, Floyd sent Hap Arnold on a special mission. He took, on the summer of 1934, right after they finished flying the airmail, 10 brand new YB-10, Martin YB-10s, from Washington, D.C., to Fairbanks, Alaska, and back. This is really cutting-edge stuff. No one has, well, they actually had done this in 1920. They'd flown up there. It took them weeks and weeks and weeks, and plane crashes, and National Geographic went along with them. It was a massive effort, but it was more of a stunt. Hap Arnold, with his executive officer, Hugh Knerr, K-N-E-R-R. There's the map. I don't know if you can see it very well, but you can see the route that they got drawn up. They're talking to the press about what they're fixing to do. They lead this flight in 1934. Here's the air crews of it. You can see the B-10, the YB-10. There's Hap in the middle. There's Hugh Knerr. You can go along. You can read the names of luminaries from the Second World War on this, on their chest. You can actually, with a good photograph and a loop, you can actually read their names pretty well. This is the flight. The B-10's leaving Washington, D.C. on the 18th of July, 1934. And guess what? They fly up to Fairbanks, Alaska. They show up on time. They only have one minor accident, and they keep that out of the press. They get the airplane flying back. So guess what? The airplanes all show up in D.C. on time, when they're supposed to be there, all of them looking brand new. They prove that they could fly anywhere they needed to in the continent to support the United States military. This is a big deal for the aviators because they're looking for a mission, and the mission they want is coastal defense. Traditionally, the Navy is in charge of taking care of anything coming into the country, but the Army was in charge of coastal defense. Since the beginning of the Republic, it had been that way. And there was a very easy way to tell how far this would go. How far could a cannon fire? On a really, really good day with a really big cannon, you might get 21 miles. So that was the line. At 21 miles, the Army, off the coast, the Army picks it up. Everything else is the Navy's. Well, the Army wants this, the Army aviators in particular, because it's a real defensive mission. It's not flying the forest fire stuff, which other people can do. This is a real combat mission. They're trying to find this. What they proved now is they can take these airplanes and go from one coast quickly to the other. We only had one fleet at the time. We didn't have seven fleets. American military posture was you have one fleet. If the bad guys attack on the west coast, the fleet would sail from the east coast down to the Panama Canal and fight them there. but it would leave the other side. So what if you have the bad guys and then another group of bad guys attacking at the same time, like the English and the French, or the Germans and the French? What happens? Hap Arnold and his people are saying, we can do both. Benny Foy pushes it. That's what Billy Mitchell was trying to do with the sinking the Osprey's loan, was to prove they can do this thing. Now they've proved they can do this on a routine basis, this 3,700-mile trip up and back. It looks routine. It comes off of it, basically without a hitch, winning Hap Arnold his second McKay Trophy. He gets a second one for this. Just as important as proving the capability of the Army Air Corps. This is a major educational experience for Hap Arnold. He learns what it requires to deploy a large force outside of the continental United States. This is a big deal for him. In just a few years, this is 1934, and in just a few years, he has to do that very thing. He has to know about R&D, the newest airplanes. He has to know about logistics. He has to be a commander. He has to know the maps. He has to know, oh, wait a minute, there's no airfields. How do we get around not having airfields in this uncharted area around Alaska? He has to figure these things out. And for somebody who finished 60 out of 110, he turned out to be a pretty bright boy. While he's at Marchfield, still, he starts making some friends of other people. He runs into Milliken again, who now is the president of Caltech. So he's right in the center of the most bubbling area of American scientific thought. He also runs in this guy, Theodore von Karman. He's the world's leading authority on wind tunnels. Hap Arnold knows whose brains to pick and where to go. He figures this out. It's these two men who cement Hap Arnold's trust in academia and engineers. And this stands him good stead in World War II. The airmail fiasco has another thing. The flight to and from Alaska is not enough to save Benny Foy's job. And he finally steps down. The Army decides to instigate a major reorganization of the military. And at this time, the Army Air Corps is split into two separate groups. They take what the Army pilots had wanted all along. They take all the operational aircraft and put them in one unit. They put everybody else, all the training, doctrine, supply, medical, everybody else goes over here. That's the Army Air Corps. The other one is GHQ Air Force, General Headquarters Air Force. It's what the Army pilots want. They quit fighting for independence because they have autonomy. And they have what is fundamental to American air power today is you have one person in charge of the striking arm. And this person is Frank M. Andrews. He's wearing a one star. He puts a second on not long after this. He's in the controls of a B-10 right now. He's made the commander of the GHQ Air Force in 1935. R&D, training, supply, all the support stuff for Army Aviation is in the Air Corps. And the chief of the Air Corps is Oscar Westover, another major general. Now, there's a real problem. His boss is the Chief of Staff of the United States Army. Frank Andrews' boss is the Chief of Staff of the United States Army. So if they want to, they can play one off the other. This is dividing command. This is not good. And the Army pilots, the forward thinkers, this is all right. We can work around this. And we got to figure out a way to do this. And to avoid a disaster, they hit on a really top-flight solution. It was really simple, absolutely perfect. This guy, Hap Arnold. He's an operational, he's an ops guy. He's an R&D guy. He's a supply guy. He understands public affairs. He understands how to move paperwork. They bring him from the ops world and stick him into the supply world. They make him the deputy commander, deputy chief of the Army Air Corps. So his long experience is used to tie them both over. And this is how they keep things from getting all screwed up, is he's the go-between between both sides. He sees both sides, and he's perfectly suited to do this, and he does it very, very well. He's promoted to Brigadier General, and he goes to Washington, D.C. Things change drastically in 1938. On the 21st of September, 1938, Oscar Westover, again, notice he's wearing his civilian clothes, is flying in an Army plane. This is an A-17AS, very similar to our A-17 on the floor over here. He's an older man. He was an artillery guy. He learns to fly. If he's going to be the chief of the Army Air Corps, he should at least know how to fly, so he flies. This airplane is way too hot for him, and he ends up flying. It was the equivalent of the Air Force Association out there having a convention in Burbank, and he's flying out there. He lost control of the airplane, kills himself, and his mechanic is traveling with him. So now, this triumvirate of Andrews, Westover, and Arnold is broken up. And there's a real fight over who's going to be the new chief of the Army Air Corps. And a lot of people did not like Hap Arnold. They thought he'd done some things that were inappropriate, which was not true. They misunderstood. Remember the photograph I showed you of Hugh Nur, who was his exec on the flight to Alaska? Arnold got the medal. Arnold got the trophy. And Nur misunderstood. He thought that Arnold had cut everybody else out of it. And that was not the case. Arnold had gone to bat and gotten in trouble for trying to get medals for everybody else, but it didn't work. The Army said, no, you get one medal, you represent everybody. Well, Nur didn't find this out until the 1960s when he was being interviewed and somebody said, well, I spoke to Arnold and he said, no, that's not what happened. And but Nur kind of got in the way. They started spreading rumors around about Hap Arnold drinking. Hap had a drinking problem. But they exaggerated, said he can't do anything, he's incompetent, he's a drunkard, can't do anything. Whisper campaign, but Franklin Roosevelt and his staff looked around and they figured that, okay, he can do the job. That's all we care about. He had done well. So, Hap Arnold becomes the new chief of the Army Air Corps. And this is, he's being given the oath. You'll notice he's wearing a civilian clothes by a clerk in civilian clothes. This is just a clerk working in the War Department, in the munitions building. Gives him the oath of office to be the chief of the Army Air Corps. They could not have made a better choice. This is September 1938. Remember what happened in early 1938? Adolf Hitler running around, Sudetenland running around. Franklin Roosevelt was sitting in his car outside of the hospital, listening while his son was in the hospital, listening to Adolf Hitler at Nuremberg giving a speech. Roosevelt could speak German fluently, so he didn't need a translation. And he turned, this was in March, turned to the people in the car and said, this means war. He understood in early 1938 that war was coming, and he fortunately chose the right man to head the Air Force. In November 1938, right after he becomes the chief of the Air Corps, FDR has a secret meeting, brings in all of his staff members who have anything to do with the defense, except, strangely enough, the Secretary of War is left out, who does not really support aviation enough. And he tells them, he doesn't say we're going to do it, he tells them, the United States is changing its defensive posture, going to emphasize the building of aircraft, and the Army's air arm was going to be central to the national defense. This was what? Everything that Billy Mitchell could have hoped for. Hap Arnold's book wrote about this event, and he said that this is when the Army Air Corps had quote, achieved its Magna Carta, unquote. He had the training, he had the education, he had the experience to fill the job that Roosevelt wanted done. This was a massive undertaking. They were asking for 10,000 planes, which was kind of like asking us to go to the moon. It really was at that level. Hap Arnold gets to work. And he touches everybody he knows for help. He goes to industry and asks for their help. He gets them to promise stuff without written orders, without even a dime going to them. Just his word that I will take care of you and I'll make sure that this works out. They start building up like they're supposed to. This is a photograph of him in 1940. A lot of y'all probably know this is Boss Kettering. That's Knudsen, who's in charge of production during World War II. This man is in charge of wind tunnels for General Motors, who is building airplanes, the Allison engine and such. And here's Hap Arnold meeting him here at Wright Field in 1940 for a discussion and conference. He's going to show them what they need. He has the contacts, and they trust him. Hap Arnold had a great story. After he got back and the president said what he wanted, he went to his staff and said, all right, guys, I need to know how many airplanes we're going to need to fight war all around the world. And he gave him a few hours and he came back in and they'd written on a tablet, on a board, a number of airplanes. And it was like about a quarter of what he thought was going to be necessary for the first year. He said, no. I mean for the entire world, not just the Philippines, but everywhere, Europe too. They said, oh, okay, boss. He goes out, he comes back in, guess what? Now they're like 90% of what he, less than 10% of what he needs. He left that board up on his wall for the rest of the war. Just whenever people weren't thinking big enough for him, he would point to that board and tell them the story. Very effective training tool. So now we have a man who understands operations. He understands logistics. He understands R&D closely. He also knows that training facilities are necessary. In 1936, he was talking to people about, it takes 5 years to build an Air Force. It takes 5 years to build an Air Force. This is 1938 and 39. He's talking about 5 years to build an Air Force. Add 5 years to 1938, 1939, and you have the United States Army Air Forces, which went out and won World War II in the air. The man knew of what he spoke. He took this little army that had about 2,000 airplanes and 21,000 personnel, period, 1939. That's how they had. And by the peak, they had 79,000 airplanes and 2.3 million men just in the U.S. Army Air Forces. This is quite a deal. To do this also required a major reorganization, which he accomplished by June 20, 1941, where he changes the Army Air Corps and it becomes the U.S. Army Air Forces of World War II. He merges all this together into a single organization. He's in charge. All the combat forces are under his command. All the supply side are under his command. Takes care of the problem that was beforehand. And now, the United States Army Air Forces are equal in authority to the Navy and the ground forces of the Army. He got involved in really mundane things, too. Here he is. They're not walking around looking for cigarette butts on the ground. They're at, see the little X on the airplane over there? These are the 1941 maneuvers and the Carolina maneuvers. Half Arnold told them, because he knew the British were doing this, he wanted something that could be easily laid out. This is pierced steel planking, PSP. And they're trying to figure out how to make it. He's out inspecting it for these, at his direction. He understands the importance of technology. He had just been to Alaska. He knew that you need to build airfields quickly, so he does that. It's experience again in research and development. When the United States enters the war in December 1941, the United States Army Air Forces had a daunting task in front of it. It had a truly global mission. It was going to fight everywhere around the world, every weather condition, sand, snow, heat, rain. This is a projection of American air power on a global scale. And the person who's there to do it is Half Arnold. He understands. Now, this is a photograph of him in Egypt in 1943. I think it's kind of representative. He went out. He stayed, for the most part, in D.C. during the war. But he went out on inspection tours. Not only that, he supports the WASPs, Women Air Force Service Pilots. He supports African Americans flying. If you go out and look at their aviation engineer battalions, Hap Arnold was instrumental in creating those, Tuskegee Airmen. Again, he was thinking far ahead of his contemporaries. On the technology side, he pushes the B-29 and the B-26, long range, very long range bombers. He also pushes jet fighters. He brings back the jet engines from England. He brings back radar. He goes over to England just in time to see the first buzz bombs hit. He brings that back. He knows the Germans are doing rockets. He sees this. We've got to keep following in that direction. And he starts pushing everybody to think about that. Electronic warfare gets increased importance under Half Arnold. And there are people there who are able to help him because he knows how to tap into American industry and science and academia. Perhaps one of his most important creations is the Air Force Scientific Advisory Board. This is their first meeting. You can see Theodore von Karman sitting right there. And Half Arnold put them to work. He told this team of scientists to go out and think. He didn't have the term outside of the box the way you overuse today, but he wanted them to think about where the Air Force should be in 20 to 50 years. And they went out and they did it. They came up with a report called Toward New Horizons. This report recommended things like, rockets, going into space, supersonic speed, everything the modern United States Air Force does, these people thought about it, at the direction of Half Arnold. So his footprint, his fingerprints, still are on the United States Air Force today. In December 1944, Half Arnold is promoted to general, a five-star general, general of the Army. This is the United States' highest military rank. This means he's made it. He's on the Joint Chiefs of Staff He has made it. The war is over, successfully concluded in 1945, and in June of 1946, Hap Arnold retires from the military. He goes back to Sonoma, California, with his wife, Bea, and their dogs. He liked Cocker Spaniels. Again, a good photograph because there's a dog. But he didn't just retire. And there's a whole series of photographs of him riding horses and working in the garage and doing this stuff. This is not really what's going on. Everybody who has anything to do with military aviation comes out to talk to him. He's involved with the B-36 controversy. Carl Spotts makes regular trips out to talk to him. He's still very, very important in national defense. Also, he writes his memoirs. Global Mission. Interesting book, not easy to read. He can't get dates right. He screws up dates a lot. But this is published in 1949. This details the rise of American military air power for the first half of the 20th century. This is the place to start, is this book. And he pretty much wrote it by himself. He had help, but he pretty much wrote it by himself. In recognition of what he had done, Harry Truman changed him to General of the Air Force, the first and only General of the United States Air Force. It's Hap Arnold. Five stars. This is 1949. He goes out. This man has seen the transition from the earliest flyers, flew with Orville Wright, knew Orville Wright, to jets. Here's a photograph of him talking with a pilot of a TF-80 in 1949. This is late autumn, 1949. January 15th, 1950, Hap Arnold died at his home. And befitting a man of his stature and what all he had done for the Republic, he was given a state funeral. He's buried at Arlington Cemetery, very simple stone. With any luck, I think I may have convinced you that whenever you walk through any gallery, the National Museum of the United States Air Force, you are going to see the imprint of this man in one form or another. Perhaps not directly, but by those he taught and brought along with him. So I think we can safely say he's the greatest visionary in Air Force history.